Today, we celebrate the strength and courage of two men and a woman. Many more were involved, of course, but Jackie, Rachel, and Branch take center stage. Welcome to In the Bullpen with Mark Dewey, sponsored by Developing Contenders Ministries. You're listening to the Fight Laugh Feast Network. Thank you for joining us.
And look who's coming up. High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
Last Monday, April 8th, we celebrated 50 years since number 714. That home run hit by Hank Aaron in Atlanta against the Los Angeles Dodgers. This week, April 15th, we celebrate how that event and that career was made possible. Humanly speaking, if it wasn't for Jackie Robinson, there would never have been a career in Major League Baseball for Hank Aaron. For that matter, for many others who have become Major League Baseball players since 1947. And the careers of all of us who have had the privilege to play at that level would be less satisfying, if not for Branch, Jackie, and Rachel, along with a cast of many others. It would be less satisfying for us all as fans. Today, April 15th, 2024, is Jackie Robinson Day, the 77th anniversary of that day in 1947 when Jackie Robinson played first base at Ebbets Field for the Brooklyn Dodgers, breaking the long-standing color barrier, breaking the so-called gentleman's agreement in Major League Baseball. Now, not only is there a straight line of connection between Jackie Robinson and Hank Aaron as it regards Major League Baseball and their careers, Bob Costas once told a story about how this connection existed before Henry Aaron became a professional baseball player.
Sometime in the late 1940s, the Dodgers were barnstorming up, as teams used to do. Dodgers trained in Florida. They're barnstorming up to Brooklyn before the start of the season and stopping off in various places to play exhibition games. So they stop in Mobile, and young Henry Aaron, 13 years old, whatever he was, skips school to see Jackie Robinson address a small group of black citizens in Mobile, Alabama, at a drugstore. He skips school to see this. Then he goes to the game, and he doesn't have the money to pay for a ticket. And he climbs a tree behind the right field fence, which had a view of the field. And from there, he catches a glimpse of his baseball idol.
What a great story. So good, as a matter of fact, you may have heard toward the end there, Bob Costas got choked up. But why would Jackie be Henry Aaron's baseball idol? Why do any of us, to this day, admire, respect, and honor Jackie Robinson? Why is Major League Baseball having yet another Jackie Robinson Day today? There are multiple reasons. I want us to consider one in particular, which is this. What Branch Rickey decided to do, what Jackie Robinson agreed to be a part of, what Rachel Robinson so profoundly supported her husband in doing, was not safe. It wasn't safe for Branch Rickey to go against decades of, quote-unquote, the way things are done around here. What the cost potentially was, I'm not sure. Probably at least costing him a job and maybe his reputation. But to whatever degree it wasn't safe for Branch Rickey to make this attempt at such an audacious move, as they would have said at that time, it was exponentially more dangerous for Jackie Robinson to say yes to being the player to break the color barrier. I've said it before in recent years dealing with Jackie Robinson Day that I am confident that I would not have had the courage and self-control of Jackie Robinson to do what he did. But also, I don't know that I would have had the courage and self-control to do what his wife, Rachel, did. because it was far from safe for her as well. I am grateful to the Lord and to Branch, Ricky, Jackie, and Rachel Robinson that none of them decided to do what was safe. Had they done so, history in Major League Baseball and beyond would look much differently, again, from a human perspective. While they didn't play it safe, neither did they go about this monumental task recklessly. All three of them knew what was at stake. They knew what it would take for the color barrier in Major League Baseball to be broken and broken successfully. They understood the danger, at least in a twofold way. It was far from safe, and they had to be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. None of them, but especially Jackie Robinson, could afford to think, speak, or act with reckless abandon. So they were neither safe nor reckless. And so today we celebrate Jackie Robinson Day yet again, the 77th anniversary. As I mentioned, not only Hank Aaron, but players before Hank Aaron and since him have had the opportunity to play this great game at the Major League Baseball level because of Jackie Robinson. Some of those players, those playing today, are among those highlighted from last year's Jackie Robinson Day.
The 76th anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking Major League Baseball's color barrier.
His courage in the face of adversity is as much an example now as ever before, and it should be fun. It is a perfect afternoon for baseball here.
Watching all the guys wear 42 on the same day, and you know the special meaning behind it.
These beautiful Jackie Robinson cleats.
Got a box of cleats today from Nike that has number 42 on them.
To honor an icon.
Thank you, 42.
And he is another one, Tommy. He just keeps on hitting.
He's a dynamic kind of player, the way Jackie was. There's no question about that.
Nice slide.
A play at the plate. He's saved.
Swung on and crushed. Forget about it.
That is way out of here.
You know, Jackie Robinson, he paved the way for all the young African-Americans like myself. So to win, it means so much. And always look forward to April 15th when it comes.
We do look forward to April 15th when it comes, and that is today. You heard one comment in there about Jackie Robinson, his courage in the face of adversity. I believe that sums up his life well. And it sums up well the point I'm trying to make today. That is, neither safety nor recklessness. Of course, there are no highlights for today, since as I speak, nothing is going on. Actually, that's not 100% true. There may be activities already underway, pregame activities in Boston, because today is not only Jackie Robinson Day, but in Boston it's Patriots Day, the day in which the Boston Marathon is run, the day each year in which the Red Sox play at 11:10. So as I speak, they may be already observing Jackie Robinson Day for 2024. When you hear this, even if you listen to it immediately at noon when it drops, that will already be well underway. But there will no doubt be several highlights of this day. I would encourage you to watch for them, to keep track of them. If you can't see them today, to look back at them in the next several days. Switching topics, but staying on point. A topic of conversation in the baseball world that has been going on for many years now has been really the topic of conversation in the baseball world over the last 2 weeks. And I mentioned it last week. That conversation has to do with arm injuries for pitchers and the necessity of those injuries being, quote-unquote, fixed by surgery, in particular, Tommy John surgery and elbow injuries. Just in the last couple of days, Braves pitcher Spencer Strider had to have surgery on his elbow. He did not completely tear his UCL, but there was enough damage that he had to have an internal brace put on, and he will be out for the remainder of the 2024 baseball season. The good news is he did not need his second Tommy John. He's already had one back in 2019 when he was at Clemson. But this is the issue being talked about all around the game and ultimately, really, from Major League Baseball down. Now, last week, there was a clip about 4.5 minutes long going around. I'm sure you can still find it. I would encourage you to find it and listen to it. But a clip of Justin Verlander when he was asked a question about this particular issue. Again, it's worth listening to all of it. But here is the last minute or so of what Justin Verlander said.
And the trickle down permeates all the way to Little League Baseball. You know, everybody's trying to get to this level. So, you know, you want to go play D1, now you got to throw hard and you got to spin the ball well. You want to go to the minor leagues, you got to throw hard, spin the ball well. And, you know, it all starts from here down. The second that you start incentivizing pitching and guys are getting drafted because they can pitch and get guys out, then that goes down a level and then down a level and down a level. And, you know, I just hope that we don't wait too long. Because it's obviously a pandemic, and it's going to take years to work itself out. Because everybody right now, Little League on, go look no further than Instagram. I can't look at my Instagram feed without seeing, you know, some kids trying to learn how to throw as hard as they can at 10 years old. I sure as hell didn't do that. You know, I didn't figure it out until college. I matured into my body. I was, you know, I say it all the time. If I came up in today's world, I don't know what would happen. My mechanics were a little different. I was tall, langly, lean, skinny, lean, weird, kind of hadn't hit my maturity. Went to college, didn't get drafted, went to college and kind of grew into myself. And all of a sudden started throwing hard. But it wasn't because I did some, you know, program to make me throw harder. So it's hard.
So there you have it. A future Hall of Famer wonders what would have been had he grown up in today's game. Think about that. Listen to what he said, even in that clip. Again, I encourage you to listen to the whole clip, but even in what you just heard, where he is now and how he got there compared to what we think is necessary for little Johnny to become a major league pitcher. Forget about a Hall of Famer. I'm a generation older than Justin Verlander. I am obviously not a Hall of Famer. I was a slightly above average relief pitcher, but I wonder the same thing. What would have happened to me had I grown up in today's game? Verlander also said he hopes we don't wait too long with this. I've got to say, I believe we've already waited too long. A current Hall of Famer, and one from my generation, Pedro Martinez, put this out on X. When we see so many up-and-coming Major League Baseball pitchers with fewer than 200 innings in the minors, lots of muscle mass, underworked baby ligaments, and a team demanding max velo on everything they throw, we're seeing the perfect lethal combination for arm injury. Again, play that clip back. He says a lot in a very few words. Huge is baby ligaments. Huge is demanding max velo on everything they throw. Not just the fastball, everything they throw. This is indeed the perfect lethal combination for arm injury among grown men, professional pitchers, major league pitchers. How much more so for a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 17-year-old? Now, the ending of my episode from last week, I made mention of my strong views on this subject matter. And that brought about a number of responses and questions. I hope in the remaining portion of this episode to provide some answers. I've got to give some disclaimers. Maybe that's not the best word, but I want to say some things so that hopefully you'll better understand me. And, you know, as I thought about doing this, I jotted down some notes to try to keep me on track, to try to prevent this from becoming a 3-hour episode. I can't guarantee I'll stay on track, but I will guarantee you it won't be 3 hours. And then I thought, there's just so much more. In reality, if I wanted to address this as completely as even it would be need to be addressed in a general sense, it would take multiple episodes. Now, as a former pitching coach, assistant pitching coordinator, and pitching coordinator with the Milwaukee Brewers over, 2012 through 2019, I've had many opportunities to speak to this issue professionally. Today, I want to express some of my views as it regards amateur-level baseball. I've been out of professional baseball now for a little over 4 years, and I've watched a decent number of amateur-level baseball games, and I've paid attention to things going on around the country. I agree with Verlander. I believe all of this starts at the top, Major League Baseball, and trickles down all the way to Little League Baseball. What I'm about to say is more of a big-picture view. I'm not going to get into a whole lot of details, but I hope that you consider well what I have to say. As I said, some disclaimers. I want to tell two stories, And I'm telling them in hopes that you don't misunderstand my perspective, because I'm going to say some things, and if I don't tell these stories, you might think I have a perspective that's not entirely accurate. So last year in college baseball, in the Super Regionals, a senior pitcher, so a grown man, 21, 22, 23 years old, somewhere in that area, I believe for Stanford, pitched in a regional game, Super Regional game, and threw 157 pitches. And people were going ballistic about it. This is a grown man. And as people are going ballistic about it, somebody, I don't remember who, made the comment on social media, let's assume that that his coach knows him better than any of us, of which it's like, absolutely, that's the case. Now, he was a senior at the end of the year. I was a senior at Grand Valley State University at the beginning of the year when this happened. Now, understand, Grand Valley State University is in Michigan. Therefore, when we're doing our practice after the first of the year, it's all inside. We don't get outside until we travel down to Florida for our spring trip. So the very first time that my spikes get into dirt, the very first time I take a true mound and throw two pitchers in a live game is on this trip. The very first start of that year for me, the very first game that we played, I believe was against Flagler College. But I started that game, and it was a 9-inning game. And I had pitched 8 2/3 innings. We had a lead, maybe 7-3, 7-4, somewhere in that area. And I threw a pitch. I got a fly ball to left field. Game over. Let's celebrate. Problem is, the ball was dropped. The game wasn't over. So I'm thinking, okay, I got to get this guy. Out walks our coach, Andy Chopp. Coach Chopp comes to the mound and says, I got to take you out. John Swisher, who was catching me that day, and I were arguing with Chopper. No, let me stay, let me stay, let me stay. Chopper said, I can't. You've thrown 157 pitches. I got to take you out. Fast forward to 2 days later. On day two, I was doing my typical routine between starts. I went down to the bullpen while we were playing our game, did a core workout, then got a catcher and started throwing a bullpen. Then I look, and Coach Chopper's walking to the mound and gives the signal, and I come in and pitch in relief. That's college baseball. Now let's go to pro baseball. In 1989, I am converted to a closer. I'm in San Jose, California, in the California League, high A ball. My manager is Dwayne Espy. I spend the whole season as a closer, which means typically probably 2 2/3 innings would be the most I pitch in any game. The next year, I start the season at the double A level, Shreveport, Louisiana, pitching for the Shreveport Captains. Again, I'm a closer, so 2 2/3, 2 2/3, probably the most I would pitch. We win the first half. I get called up to triple A. I go to Phoenix. Dwayne Espy, my manager from the year before in San Jose, is now the manager in Phoenix. The very first game that we're playing, that I'm there in AAA, we've got a 1 or 2 run lead. Our pitching coach comes down and says to me, listen, you're going to close here as well. However, we want to kind of break you in a little bit more gently. So if the score stays the same, we're going to have, I think it was Randy McCammett, is going to come in and close this out. Well, the score stayed the same. Randy McCammett came in, but the game ended up being tied. Tied through the 9th, the 10th, the 11th, and then in the 12th inning, I come in to pitch. I'm the last guy they have. And I then proceed to pitch 9 innings. Don't want to exaggerate this fish story here. 9 innings. So Ralph Nelson, who I believe was the assistant general manager for the San Francisco Giants at the time, was at that game. It's like 1:30 in the morning in Phoenix, and I'm walking up into the clubhouse at Phoenix Muni, and he's there. And he looks at me and he says, you showed me something tonight. Now, when I was drafted just as a filler. I was a guy that could throw strikes. I was a guy that was not going to cause any problems. But now, in 1990, I'm considered the top minor league relief prospect for the Giants. Can you imagine if Dwayne Espy had done that in today's game? But see, both Coach Chopper and Dwayne Espy knew me. They knew what I was capable of. I remember telling that AAA story to Dan O'Brien when he was an assistant GM with the Brewers, and Craig Counsell, who at that time was also in the front office, hadn't been named the manager yet, and they were just both astounded that such a thing could happen. Now, in neither case was I abused. Both Coach Chopper and Dwayne Espy understood who I was and what I could do and not do. So I say that so that you don't misunderstand some of the things I'm about to say. First of all, I want to address the issue of an undue emphasis on being safe, or what some people call today, safetyism. Some of my favorite books to read are The Chronicles of Narnia. I think my favorite line from any of those books is found in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It is so much my favorite that as you go up our stairs to go up to the upstairs where the bedrooms for the children are, at the top of the stairs, there's a quote on the wall from that book. I'll get to the quote in a minute. I have to set it up a little bit if you're not familiar with The Chronicles of Narnia. So there are four Pevensey children. They have gone into Narnia, which is another world different from what they're used to, and they have met two beavers, Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. And they're at the beaver's dam and in their hut, eating, drinking, having great conversation. And then the conversation turns to Aslan, the lion. And the children are feeling intrigued by this Aslan. They're excited. They're curious. But then they start having some significant trepidation. They're a little bit scared of meeting Aslan. They're beginning to discover what is said in the book, that he isn't a tame lion. And so finally, Lucy, who's the youngest of the children, asks, "Then he isn't safe?" And Mr. Beaver responds, "Safe? Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you." Well, many things aren't safe, but they are good. When we're talking about raising children, when we're talking about training and developing people, athletes, pitchers, those who are pursuing with passion and with pleasure excellence in any area of life, we're talking about something that is far from safe. Nobody in any sphere of life has ever attained excellence by playing it safe. Now, I want to give you a couple of quotes by two men who worked in professional baseball, including at the major league level, and they were both strength and conditioning guys. One is Vern Gambetta. He wrote, "We're so overprotective of the athletes that we've created fragile athletes. We're not preparing them for the rigors of what happens in the game." Another one, a friend of mine who's been on this podcast as a guest, Mark Friends. "The problem that we run into in the game of baseball is that we always want to create a safe environment so that individuals are not injured. However, in order to play it safe, we are ultimately creating a functionally unfit, deconditioned athlete." Now, these men were talking about grown men in professional baseball, but I want to take those words and apply them to young boys and young men in amateur baseball. We are creating fragile athletes because we are creating fragile boys. Boys need to get outside more. They need to explore things. They need to push the envelope in areas. They need to climb trees. I don't know if anybody climbs trees anymore. They need to fall down and get scraped up. They need to experiment and fail. This is generally, but it's also as it regards throwing, pitching. Here's another thing. We need to stop with specialization, I would say, until at least a young man graduates from high school. They need to play as many positions in baseball as they are capable of playing. They need to play as many sports as they are able to play. It may not be high school football, but play football with your friends, your family, your neighborhood, whatever the case may be. Diversify. Here's a theme that I think would be good as well. Let the kids play. I got you on that one. See, I'm opposed to it the way it's usually used, but let the kids play while the adults stay away, I believe, is very good for youth baseball people. Far too many today do virtually nothing outside adult supervision, outside of an organized practice or game. Young boys, young men should do far more that is so-called unorganized. I know. This young boy at 10 or 12 or 15 may fail. He may even get injured. That's not good, but it's life. It's baseball. It's pitching. We've got to do away with this both mental and physical safetyism. Here's something else that I believe is very important. the ability to move well, to move your body well, that is vitally important to being a good athlete, a good baseball player, and a good pitcher. And it's vitally important to remaining healthy. Here's some advice for you parents. If you have money and you want to invest that money for 10 or 13 or 17-year-old Johnny, don't use it to pay for hitting or pitching lessons. Find a knowledgeable person who knows how the body moves and how to help a body move well. Somebody like Mark Friends, and there are others out there like him. That is probably the best thing you can do for your son as it regards developing his ability and decreasing the likelihood of further injury or injury down the road. Now, kind of changing gears here. Whether this has been done intentionally or unknowingly, I'm guessing both, I've seen a lot of reckless behavior in the last 4 years when I've been paying more attention to youth baseball. Now, I live in a smaller area and therefore have a smaller sample size, but I've been at U-SSSA games, perfect games, all of that, and I also read and watch things going on around our country. I'm going to start here. If you are a schedule maker, stop it. I don't mean stop making the schedule. Stop scheduling too many games when there are not enough pitchers. It's brutal. And somebody might say, well, but it's a level playing field. Everybody has to deal with it. Absolutely. This isn't about winning and losing. It's not about the level playing field of winning or losing. It's also a level playing field for all coaches to be tempted, if not to actually give in to the temptation, to misuse and abuse young boys and young men's arms. I know a lot of leagues have something like Pitch Smart, which give guidelines that they have to abide by. That's good. However, those guidelines can be followed to a T and still be putting at risk these young boys and young men. Here's one thing I've seen a lot. And let's go to the young teenager, the guy that's now on the big field, 60 feet, 6 inches from the mound to the plate, 90 feet between the bases. I see so often this young boy, this young man, pitching and then going back behind the plate to catch, either in that same game, the next game on that same day, or the next day. This is begging for problems. It is begging for an injury. Avoid doing that. And again, it goes back to the schedule makers helping coaches to avoid being tempted to do that. If a person has to do both, I would advise against it, but at least have him catch first and then pitch. But never have him pitch and then catch that close together. Here's another thing. Throw away, mom and dad, the pocket radar. Throw away the radar guns, the stalker, the Rapsodo, whatever is being used. And also, do not engage in max velocity programs at a young age. We could talk about even at an old age, but I'm trying to stay to youth baseball right now. Now, in all that I'm saying, I don't expect any young competitive athlete to speak up and call for changes. What we need is adults to call for these changes. We need tournament organizers, coaches, parents to care about the health of the arms of their players and sons to do something to stop this insanity in youth baseball. Now, really, I've just got started. As I said, this would take multiple episodes really to go through. But here's something else I've seen both in the professional levels and the amateur level. And I think this is one of the keys. I don't know that I can say it's the key, but I think it's a very important key. Too much pitching, not enough throwing. Or too many max velocity throws, not enough low effort throws. I'm not opposed to throwing various objects of various weights and various sizes. I and all of my peers did it growing up. We threw baseballs, we threw tennis balls, we threw rocks, we threw footballs, we threw softballs, we threw basketballs. We threw pretty much anything we could get our hands on. Sometimes we threw them as far as we could. Sometimes we threw them as fast as we could. Sometimes we threw them from as funky of an arm angle as we could. Sometimes we threw them trying to hit a target. But we never did it with the intent of a max velocity effort and outcome. Throwing so often takes place only at the baseball field. And then often once I get warmed up, only at maximum intensity. We need to throw more often away from competition, away from the baseball field, or at least the organized practice, out and about. Again, I grew up throwing a tennis ball against the chimney of our house when it was nice outside and against the wall of our garage when it was not nice outside, over and over and over, but it wasn't max velo. I remember one year coaching in Helena, and I was working with Rolando Vaez. He and I were there as pitching coaches, and he had his son, Rolando Jr., who I'm going to say was maybe 8 or 9 at the time, and I was in the bullpen as we were playing a game in Great Falls. And I watched Rolando Jr. through this game. I think he had a baseball. He had a ball of some sort. I think it was a baseball. And I say he must have thrown, I'm going to say 200 throws off a brick wall they had to, you know, store turfus or something. I don't remember. And I watched that. And I thought, you know, some people are going to say he shouldn't do that. That's bad for his arm. I want to argue, no, it's not. It's good for his arm. The problem is if he was throwing as hard as he could against the wall on each of those throws, or even a far smaller percentage of those throws. My understanding of Tommy John, the Tommy John in which the surgery is now named after because he was the first one to get the surgery, and of course, being the first one to get the surgery, there's no rehab program. There's nothing there. We don't know anything yet. My understanding is that this is what Tommy John did after he had his surgery. He was at Dodger Town in Vero Beach, and he would get a bucket of balls. And 6 days a week, he didn't do it on Sunday, 6 days a week, he would take the bucket of balls, and he would simply throw baseballs off a wall. And when he found himself getting fatigued, he'd stop, pick up the baseballs, and go in. Very interesting. Yes, I get it. We know much more now than we knew then. I understand all that. However, I think there's a lot we can learn by what Tommy John did, assuming, and I think it's correct, that the story I've been told and read about is true. Throughout this episode, I've been talking about neither safe nor reckless. And it's really summed up in words we read in Scripture quite often. Be strong and courageous. And now we return where we began today. Jackie Robinson, as well as Rachel and Branch Rickey. They didn't play it safe or act recklessly. They were strong and courageous. I mentioned that we read those words in the Scriptures quite a bit, and often when somebody is taking over for a very prominent leader before them. So for instance, Moses and God repeatedly tell Joshua as Joshua is about to take over and leading the people for Moses. David told his son Solomon as David was about to exit the earth and Solomon was about to become king. See, what these men understood is that the next generation was picking up the torch and carrying on from the previous generation what was being handed down to them. And a guy like Joshua replacing Moses, a guy like Solomon replacing David, felt the weight of that responsibility. Maybe we are struggling in the game today at all levels, major leagues to little leagues, because there are too many today who are carrying torches, but doing so to burn to the ground so much of what previous generations have learned and handed down. Maybe, just maybe, what Kevin Kernan wrote about as it regards this current generation running baseball in a recent Ball 9 article needs to be given serious consideration. He called this generation the Kia generation. But that's a conversation for another day. Join us next time for In the Bullpen on the Fight, Laugh, Feast Network. Thank you for listening.